yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to turn our attention once again to the U.S. economy. Earlier this week, we had some very interesting news, and that news was that the first quarter U.S. gross domestic product, the measure of goods and services produced and sold, almost declined. It collapsed to a 0.2%. That's less than 1%, a 0.2% growth. Okay, not good. In other words, it flattened out. What's significant is that this flattening out occurs after last summer's fairly decent surge in economic growth, which in the third quarter rose to as high as 5%. And everybody was saying that, oh, we finally turned the corner and now we're on sustained economic recovery. And by the way, we heard that 4 years in a row. Because 4 years in a row, we've had a surge in the summer, third quarter, GDP, not 5% every time, but, 3 to 5%, and then it collapses. In the rest of the year, fourth quarter and early following year. This has happened four times. Now, here's some estimates of this. Okay, last quarter, fourth quarter, GDP collapsed to, grew only 2.2% after growing 5%. So it halved, more than half, slowed down to half of what it was in the third quarter of last year. And then we get this barely growth indication here of 0.2% in the first quarter. Now, this isn't the first time this happened. It happened once again last year. In the first quarter of 2014, the economy collapsed by 2.2%, even bigger collapse. And before that, we had the same thing occur, where the economy flattened out, actually declined slightly in first estimates in the fourth quarter of 2012 to only 0.2%. And then we had that in the first quarter of 2011 when the economy declined 1.8%. So in other words, we have this pattern going on. Every winter almost, we have the collapse of the economy. Sometimes it goes negative, and sometimes it's positive, or barely positive, a couple tenths of a percent. What's going on here? Now, they like to say that, oh, it's the weather. And this year, we heard this once again. We heard it last year when the 2.2% collapse occurred, and now with the flattening out. By the way, this is the first estimate. We may get a second estimate here at the end of May for the first quarter that shows an even worse performance than the 0.2%, and then there's a third estimate later in the year, which is the final. The third doesn't change much, so the next one is important, but nonetheless, could be even less than the 0.2%. But this goes on, this has been going on almost every year, fourth quarter, first quarter. Why is this? Is it the weather? Well, this year they're saying it's the weather once again, just as they did last year. But, the two previous years, no one said anything about the weather. And yet we had a collapse as well. No complaints about the weather first quarter of 2011 when it collapsed almost 2%. And, no one said anything about it with the fourth quarter of 2012 when it flattened out to zero virtually. It's only in the last 2 years that they're raising this weather claim that's the cause of this. Now, I don't buy this weather stuff. First of all, because we always have bad weather in the winter. That's what winter's about. And secondly, government statisticians correct for such seasonalities. excuse me, well, maybe not, it was more seasonal this time than before, but, you know, estimates are that, quote, the bad weather, even if you buy this idea, the bad weather accounted for only 0.5, and that was one half of 1% of the flattening out. So if the economy was growing 2.2% in the fourth quarter, the weather should have been responsible for only a decline to 1.7%. But actually, it slowed down to 1.7% growth, but actually it ended up at 0.2% growth. So where'd the other 1.5% go here between the fourth quarter and the first quarter? Well, if you look at the details, and the truth is always in the details, 1.25% of the decline, the slowdown, rather, in first quarter of this year is due to trade, exports. Exports flattened out, contracted. Okay, big problem. Exports slowing down. Now, consider this. Exports, which are mostly manufactured goods, really don't have much to do with the weather. I mean, you could claim that the severe weather slowed down construction even more, although construction pretty much slows down altogether in a winter. You could claim that, and you could claim, well, you know, people don't go out shopping and because of the weather. You know, you could use that as a plausible explanation. But, you know, when it comes to manufacturing and exports, I mean, unless the weather was bad everywhere around the world, you know, you can't say that this 1.25% decline in the trade factor, exports-imports, was really due to the weather. The weather excuse, the weather metaphor excuse, you know, is really when those who are estimating and commenting on the decline want to make it look like, oh, it's not a fault of the economy, it's a fault of the weather, you know, forecasting by weather metaphor. We've seen that happen with jobs numbers as well. They claim the same thing. So, you know, this weather argument is pretty specious, I think. And at most, it's only, you know, one half of 1%. Does not explain how we go from 2.2 to 0.2, or from 5% in the third quarter of last year to virtually no growth at all. There are real economic reasons and explanations. You know, maybe you could argue further that, you know, maybe there's something wrong with the government statistics, right? Maybe it's not the weather. That's one possible explanation that I don't buy. The other possible explanation is that, well, maybe there's something wrong with government statistics. They need to look at how they adjust seasonality. Maybe they're not picking it up adequately in the winter months, which means they're probably overestimating it in the summer months. You know, if you have a seasonality problem, it's usually a seasonality problem in both directions, overestimation in one part of the year and underestimation the other part of the year. Maybe we're not really growing at 5% in the summer. Maybe it's only like 3%, and maybe the growth in the winter is, you know, maybe 1.5%, and it all averages out to our long-run 2% growth rate that we've had ever since the, quote, recovery from the 2008-09 recession. If you look at the economy, it's been bouncing along the bottom. Short, shallow recoveries, temporary, not robust recoveries, not sustained recovery periods, followed by relapses, rather quick relapses, where the economy, the growth rate, slows to virtually zero or goes negative for a quarter. That's a stop-go scenario. And I've been arguing that is the main defining characteristic of the U.S. economy since 2009. And in fact, in my book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, which was published in spring of 2010, written in 2009, I predicted that's what would follow the recession. It would be short, shallow recoveries followed by equally short relapses. Relapses meaning a dramatic slowing in the growth rate or a one-quarter negative GDP. right? Not enough in terms of duration to call it a recession, but certainly not a robust recovery. By the way, as a digression here, you can have a recession with only a one-quarter negative GDP. You don't have to have two consecutive quarters of GDP negative growth to have a recession. In fact, recessions are defined by the National Bureau of Economic Research economists, and it has nothing to do with consecutive quarters of GDP. What does it have to do with? Well, they have a kind of eclectic formula, and the economists decide whether we went into recession or came out of recession. But the point is, you don't have to have two consecutive quarters of GDP. So, in a sense, if that's true, we may have already had a double dip, maybe even a triple dip, recession along the way. First quarter of 2011, as I said, it declined almost 2%, and first quarter of 2014 declined more than 2%. That's as much of a decline as occurred in 2001 in GDP when the NBER decided that, we had a recession in 2001. Well, they didn't decide we had a recession this time. But if we haven't had a double or triple dip, it's been a double or triple relapse, at least. Relapse is a new concept that I've introduced here to express a significant dramatic slowing in the growth rate and sometimes dipping below zero, turning negative, periodically and repeatedly. And that's what I predicted back in 2009. Now, why do we have a stop-go situation? Well, the stop-go situation, I believe, has to do with what's happening to debt and income for households. On the one hand, we have still too large a debt overhang for households, they don't really have significant income growth in households to really stimulate consumption on a robust, sustained basis going on for multiple years. You see, too much debt inhibits the ability to spend, and not enough income growth also inhibits the ability to spend. And you can't see this debt-income problem for 90% of the households because it gets absorbed, swamped, smoothed out when you look at the top 10% households that are doing quite well. You know, when you average out the income growth and the debt reduction for the very top households in this country with the rest of the bottom 90%, you lose the indication of what's really happening with 90% of the households in the U.S. And we have about, 110 million or so tax-paying households in the U.S., so the bottom 90%, are folks who are making $100,000 or less. And, you go down to the median around $60,000, and those folks aren't doing very well at all. The folks below them are doing even worse. Okay, so, if you segment the household distribution in this country, and you look at it at the median instead of looking at it in terms of averages, which are skewed by the income growth of the very top 10%, then you get a picture of the consumer that is not able to have a sustained economic growth of consumption. And we see that consumption, is volatile. It bounces up and down, and it's not really sustainable. We claim we created all these jobs, and that would be income, but most of those jobs are low-pay jobs or contingent jobs that don't generate enough income. When we say we created all those jobs, we don't say much about an equal number of jobs job-aged, 16 and above individuals who haven't been able to find jobs. In other words, the labor force keeps growing, and yes, we've created jobs for 5-6 million low-pay jobs, but there's another 5-6 million who enter the labor force who don't have jobs. So it's kind of like a churn going on in the job market, it really has nothing to do with jobless claims and all that. It's really about labor force participation and employment ratios and so forth. But we just don't have the income growth to really stimulate, and we have too much debt overhang, and that explains a lot of this stop-go, stop-go. Because when you get the go, it's temporary one-off factors that produce these 4 or 5% one-time quarterly growth rates, and then when those temporary 1% one-off factors are no longer applicable, you know, the economy sags back down again, right? And the whole history of the last 5 years in the U.S. economy is one of this one-off temporary surge, this one-off temporary surge. I'll talk about those shortly that give us these single quarter boosts, and when they dissipate, we slow back down to 1.5% on average or less quarterly growth rates, and then it all averages out to 1.8 or 2% growth rates for the longer period. Now, another problem we have in this economy, and why we have stop go beyond just debt and income problems for the bottom 90%, is business investment. We just aren't getting the real business investment that we used to get. I mean, when I say real business, I mean investment in goods and services producing investment. Why is that? Because businesses are sitting on hoards of cash. I'm talking about medium and large businesses in particular. And banks aren't really lending to the small businesses to really create the jobs. So we got a problem. Well, why do we have a problem with such cash hoarding going on? You know, the banks are sitting on $2.2 trillion of excess reserves, cash, that they should be loaning out, but they're not. And large multinationals are sitting on about $1.5 trillion. That's not counting, you know, maybe an equal amount in trillion stuffed in their offshore subsidiaries that they're not bringing back because they won't pay taxes on it. And even though they are tax frauds going on of all kinds, like tax inversions and so forth, no one in the government goes after these illegal business practices. You know, no one gets thrown in jail in business for this huge tax fraud game that they're playing. But what's happening is corporations and businesses are, particularly the larger ones, are using all this cash instead of investing in expanding production. They're using it to stock buybacks and dividend payouts. Yeah, if you look at stock buybacks and payouts before the 2008-09 recession, stock buybacks were about $190 billion for the S&P 500 companies. I'm just talking about the largest 500 companies. It was about $192 billion, I think the number is, and then we have roughly the same number for or less a little less for dividend payouts. And was it 2005, something like that. But then since 2009, it's been rising dramatically. And what you've got is last year, well, in 2014, $900 billion in combined stock buybacks and dividend payouts. And this year, estimated by Goldman Sachs and investment research, over $1 trillion, an additional $1 trillion in buybacks and dividend payouts. And if you add them all up in the last 5 years since the recovery, it's about $5 trillion have been paid out in stock buybacks and dividend payments in just the S&P 500 companies. Well, no wonder personal income is rising, but it's rising for the folks who had the stocks, who owned the stocks, which is not the rest of us. It's maybe 5% or so of the population that really has significant stock positions, equity positions. The rest of us live by earning and selling our labor. So $5 trillion. Mm. Well, no wonder we have all this income going to the wealthiest 1%, which own most of the stock, by the way. The recent data showed that and this is University of California estimates here, my professor Emmanuel Sias, who has this database based on IRS income reports, last year, well, it was estimated in his piece, Striking It Richer, that the wealthiest 1% since 2010 have accrued 91% of all the net income gains. In other words, all the additional gains in GDP and net income have gone to the 1%, 91%. Yeah, under George W. Bush it was 65%, and under Clinton it was 45%. 91%. Well, no wonder we have such terrible income inequality going on, which is getting worse fast, you know? Obama has presided over the worst income redistribution shift in the history of this country. So, you know, the debt and the income is not a problem for the wealthiest 1% or 10%, you know, with that kind of income gain. They pay down their debt, and, you know, they are able to purchase, but, you know, most of them don't spend that money, they invest it. And the problem is both the corporations and the bankers and the wealthy elite are not investing in U.S. jobs, in U.S. businesses anymore. They're investing offshore, at least until recently. And offshore investing not just in real assets, you know, building infrastructure and so forth and companies, but also in financial markets offshore and onshore. So a lot of the money is going into stock buybacks. A lot of it's going offshore. A lot of it's going into financial asset investment, which is driving stock and bond markets, derivative markets, and so forth. And they still have trillions that they're sitting on. Corporate profits, about $5 trillion increase over 2008 levels. $5 trillion increase. Wow, that's just about what the stock and dividend buybacks have been, $5 trillion. And they're still sitting on trillions because they raise all this extra cash by selling corporate bonds, junk bonds, investment bonds, and so forth. So they're still fat with cash, even though they pay out $5 trillion, even though they made net $5 trillion more in corporate profit. If you want to read this piece, just go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, where I have this piece written for Telesur Media called How the Rich Get Richer in the USA. Okay, so let's go back to the U.S. economy. You know, I mean, this diversion was to explain, you know, why we have this stop-go. And the stop-go is the fact that four times now since 2009 recovery, the economy has collapsed for at least a quarter to zero or less. And conversely, it rises to 4 or 5% for a quarter, you know, this real volatile stop-go scenario that averages out to less than 2% real growth rate over the period. By the way, if you look at Europe and Japan, the same phenomenon, the stop-go, is occurring, except it's occurring at a much a lower level to begin with. It's not so much in Japan and Europe that you have a slowdown, you know, in the growth rate. There you have very clear double, triple dip, quadruple dip recessions since 2009. Japan has had four recessions, bona fide recessions. Europe has had two, maybe three. They're bouncing along the bottom below the flat rate, the zero rate. And we're bouncing along just a little bit above it. So it's a global phenomenon. And it seems like China, which is structurally quite different than these other advanced economies, is slowing rapidly as well. And therefore, most emerging markets are slowing rapidly. And as the global slowdown occurs, drifting with the shifts, sometimes, not in a linear decline, but the global slowdown of the global economy is occurring long term. That's pretty clear. We're drifting towards deflation all over the globe. Prices, consumer goods and services prices, are drifting while financial asset prices are booming. And that's because there's not enough real investment. And the investment in goods and services that would have been there is being diverted into financial asset investment. And that's why financial asset markets, equities, and debt are booming. And the rich folks who focus on that kind of investment are making money hand over fist. And the rest of us who depend on jobs from real investment are struggling, right? So this is a phenomenon that's quite important, you know, slowing investment, deflation in goods and services, inflation in financial assets, slowing global economy. And I'll be talking about this more this summer when my book comes out, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, which is really an extension of my previous analysis of the U.S. economy stop-go to the global economy itself. Okay. But let's get back to this first quarter GDP numbers. You know, let's get more specific here and look at this. First of all, we reject this idea that it's the weather. Okay. Very clearly, it might be a statistical problem, statistical procedures that need adjustment. And it might be that there are real issues here, real economic issues, when you look below the surface, that are responsible for this stop-go and these flattening, collapse, negative experiences here in winter first quarter GDP. Okay, so what might be the real factors? We'll put aside whether it's it's the statistical problem, statistical measurement problem. That could be too. And we're certainly rejecting the weather problem. Okay, so that leaves us with what are some of the real factors, temporary, one-off developments, that explain why we've periodically got these boosts in the summer, and when these one-off factors disappear, because they're temporary, then we revert back down and collapse again. In the winter, that could be the long-term scenario, what's going on. Well, if you look at some real factors, let's look at government spending for the last several years. Of course, whenever we have an elections, national elections, which we had in 2014, and before that, 2012, whenever we have these elections, we get a boost in federal government spending. That's what the feds do. They hold it off in the winter, in the year preceding an election. They hold off spending. They bottle it up, and then they release it in December so that you get a big GDP boost in the second, especially the third quarter, right before the November elections. And they do that purposely so the economy looks like, oh, it's doing real good, right? And the incumbents say, oh, look, you know, we've turned the corner, vote for me. So that happened in 2012 and 14. Well, what about 2013? Well, 2013 was all about this sequestration, fiscal cliff. If you remember, they, resolved that fiscal cliff in January or February of 2013. And by the way, the essence of that was some token increases in taxes on the rich folks, a little bit, while they give them a $4 trillion 10-year tax cut. That's what the fiscal cliff was all about. Well, the whole idea was, well, if we're going to give a tax cut of that dimension to the rich and corporations, then what we've got to do is cut spending elsewhere. The problem was defense spending was linked already to social program spending. And what they did in 2013, though, was to de-link the defense spending from the sequestration, as it was called, which is a $1 trillion spending cut. They released it, and then that defense spending actually began hitting the markets in the second half of 2013. December 2013. You know, they resolved that in March, April of 2013, and then all that defense spending that was supposed to get cut got released again. So we got a one-time defense spending surge, which is what we got in 2012 and 14 in the summer. In 2013, it was due to the sequestration. So that balloons up GDP. The defense government spending side ballooned GDP in three consecutive years, and then we have the collapse when that spending You know, it doesn't occur evenly all throughout the year. It occurs periodically in the summer, and before the elections is when it occurred, and then it dissipates at the end of the year, early beginning of the year, next year. All right, so that's one possible factor there, why we get this temporary one-off boost in the summers, and then that dissipates and disappears in the winters. Another is business inventory spending. In each of the last 2 years, what we've seen is business adding to its inventories in the summer in expectation of a holiday consumer spending surge. And in both the years, 13-14, what happened was business, 12 as well, sort of bulked up on their inventories. But then what happens is the holiday spending does not materialize. So they have the excess inventories, and then they got to work them off in the beginning of the next year, the first quarter of next year, so they don't add any more inventories, and that reduces GDP, you see. So we've got this, quote, seasonal kind of thing, not a true ongoing seasonal, but having to do with the recovery where business and expectation of a recovery produces more in the summer, and then it doesn't get sold, so they have to work it off in the beginning of the winter. Those are kind of temporary examples of special events that have been occurring. I mean, typically, that would not happen, except that the recovery has been so lagging in business and thinking and anticipating, now we're going to take off, and it doesn't happen. Okay, so that is a temporary factor that is a real factor and a real development that has to be considered here when we look at what's been happening to the economy. Now, last year we had some additional temporary factors, which explain why we got such a large summer boost in GDP, 4% and 5% in the second, third quarter. You know, on top of this government spending stuff, on top of this business inventory practice, what we've gotten was special factors last year, factors which dissipated, and explain why we flattened out to nothing here in the first quarter. Okay, what were these factors last year? Well, first of all, in the first half of 2014, we had this continuing oil shale boom, an industrial production boom, you know, centered in certain parts of the country, up in the Northern Plains and in Texas and a few other places, lesser so. But the oil shale boom, oil gas shale boom, you know, very significant. Mining, business investment, transport equipment investment, railroads and so forth, and trucking, right? Regional construction, as populations boomed and so forth in those parts of the country. You know, much of the job gains really occurred, have been occurring up there in this oil patch, this gas patch. If you took that away, the job creation would have been much worse. But anyway, this was booming in the first half of last year, 2014, which got reflected in GDP in the second and third quarter. But then in the middle of the summer of last year, we had the global collapse of the oil prices, crude oil prices everywhere, and a big oil glut, and oil per barrel dropped from 120 to about 40-some dollars. I mean, a true collapse in oil. And what happened in the second half of last year as a result was with this oil shale gas boom over, pretty much, we had a big contraction beginning, and that got reflected in the fourth quarter and first quarter of this year. You know, mining, business investment, railroad transport, and all that, just the bottom fell out of that. That explains, the temporary factor, explains the summer GDP surge, but it also explains the collapse in part of GDP here in the fourth and now the first quarter. And that's probably leveled off, maybe. Some say it's leveled off. Some say that there'll be another downturn here and we'll have further contraction in the rest of 2015. Well, we'll just have to see. The point is, it's not going to be adding to GDP anymore, even if it may not be declining from GDP. Well, we'll just have to see that. But that wasn't the only factor that gave an artificial one-time temporary boost to GDP last summer. That's dissipated. Another is healthcare spending. You know, last year was the first year that they really had this sign-up of 10 million people, roughly, on Obamacare, healthcare, the ACA, Affordable Care Act, for the first time. Well, that meant that you had people spending for the first time on healthcare, both on premiums and on, co-pays and so forth, because a lot of this Obamacare sign-up stuff is on these catastrophic plans. In other words, people have some sort of coverage, but they got to spend the first $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 deductible before it kicks in. Otherwise, you know, if you try to buy it, with no catastrophic deductible, it's going to be too expensive. And that's really what ACA is about, you know, catastrophic health insurance, which is good for folks who have catastrophic health problems. For the rest of the folks who don't, they're paying and subsidizing those that do with this whole program. Okay, we'll talk about the ACA some more later in another show. But anyway, we have this surge in spending as we have all these 10 million people sign up, you know, and that's leveled off now. That initial surge, a lot of consumer spending last year was this healthcare spending for the first time for these new people signing up. And that was a temporary boost in the middle of the year, but now it's going to level off. We're not going to get significantly more than 10-11 million people signing up here in 2015. They got what they got, and the growth hereafter will be very slow. Okay, so that's an important factor. Another one is what's happened to the U.S. dollar. When their oil prices start collapsing, they did so about the time that the Federal Reserve, started talking about raising interest rates, right? Usually the dollar collapsing raises interest rates. I mean, excuse me, dollar rising after mid-year, not collapsing. The dollar continued to decline up to about mid-year last year, but once the oil price a glut began to occur at the same time the Fed starts talking about raising interest rates, then the dollar starts rising dramatically. Now, the rising dollar slows down the U.S. exports, rising value of the dollar, and that's what happened. It also impacts corporate multinational profits and therefore has an effect on their spending as well. So that factor in the first half of the last year, declining dollar, boosted exports, but then exports began to collapse, slow down dramatically in the second half of the year, and they're continuing here in the first half of the year, or first quarter at least. Now, that's not only because of talk of raising interest rates in the U.S. and declining value of the oil markets, but it's also because both Japan and Europe, in a desperate attempt to try to increase their exports and drive their currency down, introduced QE. Europe talked about it, and that had a boost for them while they were talking about it, but then they introduced it this year, earlier this year, their QE in the Eurozone, and that drove their currency down. The euro gave them an export advantage at the expense of U.S. exports, you see. Japan, that had already introduced the QE, gave it another boost last year. What's happening is Japan and the Eurozone are competing for exports in the world, and they're doing it by competitive devaluations, not devaluations by formal fiat dictate, but devaluations by money injections, QE. And that's what's behind those two major areas of $20 trillion plus maybe $25 trillion GDP, global GDP, they're trying to compete by competitive devaluations. But that drives the dollar up, you see, and that slows U.S. exports even more. So we have these multiple factors that ended up driving the dollar up in the second half of last year. And that, of course, has had a big impact on exports and therefore manufacturing, which is mostly exports, manufactured goods, U.S. exports, mostly manufactured goods, some services. And that has had a tremendous impact on U.S. GDP. And we see this really having a full effect here in the first quarter of this year when GDP pretty much flattens out. And 1.25% percentage points of GDP is due to this trade export shift, which has to do with the rising dollar, you see. 1.225% of GDP. In other words, if the GDP was 2.2% in the fourth quarter, we knocked 1.2% of that off by the first quarter of this year simply because of the trade effects, you see. Trade effects were far more important than any kind of argument based on weather. Now, as I said, the most extreme estimate of the weather's contribution to this first quarter GDP was 0.5%. Well, here we have trade, the export, the rising dollar, nearly three times as important as the weather, with this 1.25% contribution to the GDP contraction, right? Now, where is this going with trade, the dollar, exports, manufacturing, and so forth, as we go forward? Well, it's pretty much stopped the Federal Reserve from talk about raising interest rates in June. That's pretty much off the table now. And now they're saying, well, maybe in September. I don't think it's going to be in September either, because I don't think the economy is going to be strong enough for them to raise interest rates. If they do, they're going to get a very negative surprise, because I think the economy is very sensitive to any increase in interest rates. It'll have more of an effect than they think. Just as interest rate reductions had virtually no effect on the economy and stimulating real growth here in the previous years, conversely, even a small increase in interest rates will have a significant effect. Well, how could that be? How could reducing interest rates have no effect, but raising it a little have such a big effect? Well, it has to do with this relationship of debt and income in the economy. When you are heavily indebted, and you don't have a strong income growth, and that's most households and most small businesses, by the way, then any small increase in the cost of funds is going to have a negative consumer and small business spending impact. And I think that's in the cards. The Fed just doesn't know what this impact's going to be. They're on totally new ground, but they'll be unpleasantly surprised if and when they do raise interest rates, right? These three main developments of last year, the oil shale boom coming to an end mid-year, and the healthcare spending, which played itself out by the end of the year, plus this whole question of why the U.S. dollar was rising so dramatically, and this impact on trade and exports and manufacturing, are the special one-off factors. When you add them to, the surge in government spending and the business inventory surge last summer, contributed to this 5% growth in GDP in the third quarter. Right? That's what's behind it. These are real factors, real explanations. They aren't weather factors, and they aren't statistical procedure problems. They're real, okay? And they are one-off, so they dissipate. Right? They don't contribute necessarily except for a short period of time. And that's what we've seen. The oil shale boom is over, right? The healthcare is what it is. And the dollar rose for various reasons, both because of, the Fed and because of the oil glut and because of what Japan and the Eurozone were doing with QE. And all those one-off factors disappear at the beginning of the year here. And, of course, the GDP goes from 5% to no percent as a result. You've got to realize, too, that this is worth a comment, and I typically do, comment on this, that the GDP numbers we have are overestimations based on revisions to GDP that were done a few years ago. Backwards and forwards, GDP was adjusted. by at least 0.3%, maybe more, at least $500 billion a year are added to GDP because the U.S. has simply redefined what GDP is. It's taken intellectual property, you know, logos and earmarks, not earmarks, but trademarks, and intellectual property of various kinds, and cost of research and development, and it claims that these expenses are now GDP. Well, that's just the redefinition of it, which I think is faulty. We're seeing governments all around the world trying to redefine their GDP in order to get it up and look better than it is. In some places, it's really dramatic and ridiculous. Like in Britain, they're now talking about, as they have already, and elsewhere in Europe, of counting prostitution services as GDP. And drug dealing, illegal drug dealing, is part of GDP. Well, it's impossible to know what those costs are. You know, what do? You send somebody into a brothel and say, well, what are you charging for this service? Oh, how about that service? You know, and so on and so forth. And then they come out and some bureaucrat does an estimation, rolls up the numbers and says, oh, you know, British are spending so much on prostitution, so we got to add that to GDP, right? Or how about drug dealing? What do you do? You know, you go buy some dope or something and say, well, what's the cost? You know, what's your volume and so forth? You know, it's absurd. But anything to boost GDP. And then it's got really ridiculous in places like Nigeria, where they doubled their GDP overnight by redefining it. Well, it's going on everywhere in the world as they're trying to somehow eke out, you know, more economic growth than there really is. And the U.S., you know, it's much more, less extreme and absurd, but more scientific, you might say. But, you know, including this intellectual property and so forth, which continues to grow and grow and grow and add more and more to GDP as a proportion, is I think, the wrong way of looking at it. If we, therefore, deduct out this 0.3% or more, from even the numbers that we have, you know, it would be 0.3% to 0.4% of 1%, even worse. So this 0.2% positive growth in the first quarter, if we backed out these redefinitions, it would be negative. And then last year, first quarter, -2.2%, you know, that would be closer to -3% drop in GDP. Anyway, that's another thing to consider, I believe. That's important. So let's look at, what's happened here in the first quarter in a little more detail. First of all, the big reductions over the fourth quarter, we have a decline in personal consumption expenditures, you know, that were 4.4% in the fourth quarter and now less than half of that, 1.9%. Okay, you could say people didn't, go out because of the weather. You know, by the way, this weather thing is really nonsense because where did we have all this bad weather? Okay, they had some bad weather in the Northeast. Okay, you know, Boston was pretty bad with the snow and so forth, so a couple of weeks, you know, people didn't maybe go out and buy stuff. Maybe not. But that certainly wasn't the whole country, you know. I mean, except for the Northeast, the weather wasn't any different or worse elsewhere in the country, you know. So could we have such a big impact on the whole GDP for the whole country that was not seasonally adjusted normally, right? Because of those storms in the Northeast? I mean, come on, you know? No, not at all. Of course, we had also in the first quarter a decline in construction, very notably, from the fourth quarter in construction. Is that seasonal or is that excessively beyond seasonal? I don't know. We'll give you that one. We'll give you commercial construction, residential construction slowdown, you know, in the winter when we had these bad snowstorms in January, February. Okay. But we do have a slowdown in business equipment investment, okay, from the fourth quarter to the first quarter. what we have is business inventory. What happened to business inventory? Well, this is very interesting because, you know, one of my arguments here previously noted is business inventory bulks up in the summer, and then Christmas sales disappoint, and it declines. And that's been happening. Except this year, what happened was businesses continued to bulk up into the first quarter. You know, they actually reduced inventories by 0.10 in the fourth quarter. So they did a little bit of adjustment of inventories after the summer surge. But then in the first quarter, they actually, you know, added 0.75, 0.75% to GDP. What this tells me is that business is still betting that the consumer is going to come out in a sustained fashion. So they continued adding to their inventories in the first quarter, which means if they hadn't done that, if business hadn't added to the inventory in the first quarter of this year, the numbers would have been even worse. You know, if they had adjusted downwards their inventory as they had in previous 2 years in the first quarter of the next year, and if they had done that this year, we would definitely be negative. It'd be, you know, negative 0.6 or negative 0.7 GDP in the first quarter of this year. The question is, if the consumer does not really come out strongly now, business will be overextended on inventories even more than ever before. So we could see, an even more significant reduction in business inventory spending this summer. History repeats itself, but never in the exact same way. Another argument I'd like to make is let's look at March, the first quarter, March. Okay, we had bad weather in January, February. You could argue consumption and construction and so forth, right? You can't argue, manufacturing, export, shale boom, or any of that stuff. But anyway, all right, February, March, we'll give you that, all you weather metaphorists. What about March? You know, we didn't have these big, terrible snowstorms and so forth, freezes across the country in March. What do we see in March? Well, we see in March and in April now, factory manufacturing is almost flat. In fact, April's worse than March. March, it fell, factory fell, production fell to 51.5 on a scale. Anything below 50 or below is a contraction. Right? So it's flattened out. Factory and manufacturing production is flattened out at a 2-year low now. And that's because of the dollar, you know, and that issue that we talked about in trade. Right? The U.S. dollar continued to rise in March. Only recently, in recent weeks, has that appeared to be in the process of reversal. Right? And that's another topic. We'll see whether that happens. In other words, the U.S. is responding to this challenge from Europe and Japan to lower the value of their currency and steal U.S. exports. It's responding by saying, okay, we're not going to raise interest rates. And also the fact that the global oil price collapse has leveled off and actually risen a little bit, oil prices, is sort of now negating. There's this global competition going on between different sectors of capitalist economies over currency. Currency wars, they call it, and that's what we're in the middle of. Okay, so, the fact that in March and April, when there was no terrible weather, we have this problem of, nonetheless, factory and manufacturing problems continuing. Okay, and do we have the problems of the U.S. dollar rising? Well, we will see. We certainly did in March. These things have nothing to do with the weather, right? And how about construction? In March, you know, usually you get construction occurring again. Construction lowest in over a year. Lowest since June of last year. Private residential construction as lowest in a year. Usually it starts recovering in March and April, right? Public construction, state and local government, negative, right? Private residential construction in March, negative. So we have this problem of construction that you could claim the weather, but March you can't claim the weather. Housing starts are down and forecast to be down 2.5% this year compared to last year. And then we have oil prices. As I said a minute ago, we got crude oil rising again, and now we got gasoline and the refiners and the retailers taking advantage of that and boosting the price of gas dramatically. In March and April, we have an increase in gas at the pump of 20 to 30%, depending where you are in the country, almost overnight, you know. They're raising it 20 to 30%. Well, the crude oil prices did not increase 20 to 30%, but nonetheless, they're using this as an excuse, the oil companies in the U.S., refiners and the retailers, and they're jacking up their prices at the pump. Well, that's going to have a negative effect on spending. You know, all this oil price decline of last year was predicted, oh, that's going to really boost the economy by the end of the year. Well, it didn't, because, as I predicted, the data showed people would pocket that money, not go out and spend it on something else. And that's exactly what they did. Savings rates went up. Right. Okay, so we can talk about construction. We can talk about oil prices, the dollar, factory manufacturing, you know, and all those indicators are not good. And what about the job indicators? Last month, only 125,000 jobs created. We'll see what this next month, April, produces. Some are saying, oh, that's just an aberration. Well, we'll see whether that's an aberration. Jobs, of course, are a lagging indicator. They don't show immediately what's going on in the economy. They aren't a predictor. They're a lagging indicator. But we'll soon see whether these other slowing factors in the economy, U.S. economy, are going to get reflected in jobs. Okay. Now, one more piece of data point here. The Federal Reserve in Chicago has a national activity index, and it showed in March that activity index was down 0.4%. Okay, so the point I'm making is that this weather argument can't be applied to March. The weather wasn't any worse than it was in any other winter, and certainly April. But we still have continuing indicators that are showing us that there's something fundamental going on here in the economy, and it's not the U.S. economy. It's not just weather that can be used as the explanation for why we have this flattening out, once again, fourth time in 4 years, of the U.S. economy in the first quarter of this year. What we have, if you look at it in context, in detail and in context over the period, is that the U.S. economy is growing, on average, fundamentally, at about half of what its normal growth rate is. And we're already in the fifth year of a, quote, growth recovery. It's an anemic recovery. It's a weak recovery when you smooth everything out and average it all out over 5 years. Weak for everybody else who depends on real investment and real jobs and so forth. Great for those folks that want to speculate in stocks and bonds and financial assets, you see. That's where they're making all their money right now. For the rest of us, though, it's been no great recovery, and it's coming to an end. You know, the typical, quote, recoveries after recessions, recovery phases last 5 to 7 years. So we could be tripping into, the end of the recovery, as weak as it is, any time now, within the next 12 to 18 months, I believe. It may be the end of the whole process here. Yeah, well, that's an average. It might go a little longer. It may not go as long. So, what we get here is the picture of a stop-go, and we've recently stopped again in the first quarter. The temporary factors that gave us a boost last year have dissipated. And the question is, the big question, will we have once again a go this summer in the next two quarters? Well, you know, the metaphorists like to say, yes, we will. I'm not so convinced. I think the recovery will not be as strong in the real economy over the summer as it has been before, because temporary factors that were so strong last year are not there this year. Okay, we'll talk again more about the U.S. economy and my predictions longer term for the U.S. global economy and coming shows. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.